Welcome to the 2009 802.11n Wi-Fi Challenge discussion on managing the airspace for optimal performance at WebTorials. I'm Robin Leyland, an analyst in the networking industry and a host of the Challenge series at WebTorials. Join me is Joni Wexler. Joni is a writer and analyst in the industry, the author of the Network World Wireless in the Enterprise newsletter, and a longtime observer of the wireless industry. Joni will be leading today's discussion. Welcome, Joni.
Thanks, Robin.
Also joining us on Managing the Airspace, we have Chris Kozup of Cisco System. Chris is a senior manager for mobility solutions at Cisco. Welcome, Chris.
Great. Thanks to be great to be here.
Also participating is Bruce Miller, Vice President of Product Marketing at Xyrus. Welcome, Bruce.
Hi, Robin. Thank you.
And rounding out the panel is Kevin Goulet from Motorola. Kevin is a Senior Director of Marketing in Motorola's Enterprise Wireless LAN Group. I'm now going to turn the session over to Joni, who's going to ask our first question of the panel.
Okay, thanks a lot, Robin, and thanks everybody for participating in today's panel about managing the RF airspace for optimal performance in an 802.11n network. So we all know that over the years, the industry has had to continually tweak what was inherently once a pretty simple 802.11 network so that these networks could scale and meet enterprise-grade network requirements. Many of these enhancements have had to do with controlling traffic over the air in what is a wireless shared access medium so that traffic doesn't bump into other traffic, cause interference, degrade performance, and so forth. So let me just start with a simple question by asking, what, if any, new RF management challenges arise with 802.11n, the fastest 802.11 generation of technology, compared with any of the earlier generations? Chris, would you like to start with that?
Sure, yeah, and thanks, Joni. We would agree, Cisco would agree that, it's important for enterprises and businesses of all types to really think about how they're looking at managing the RF environment. It's critical to get this foundation stable and ensure that you're deploying an RF solution, a Wi-Fi solution, that has the ability to really deliver high performance, consistently performing coverage. And so I think, especially as we move into 11N, perhaps the most important thing to note is that the reliance that businesses are placing on their wireless network is increasing fairly significantly. And with that reliance in terms of more applications, applications that have perhaps are more picky, so voice, video types of applications, the importance of understanding the radio frequency environment has also increased quite dramatically. So with respect to 11N specifically, we're definitely seeing a lot more interest that customers have with respect to deploying in the 5 gigahertz frequency. And when you think about the importance of the 5 gigahertz frequency, it's obviously important to note that if you're deploying 11N, you want to be able to take advantage of the broadest amount of capacity within the network that you can. So we certainly encourage customers to look at a host of RF planning tools that allow them to deploy coverage to meet their application requirements, but also look at technologies like dynamic frequency selection, or DFS, that's mandated by the FCC to ensure that businesses can use the full capacity of the 5 gigahertz frequency. And in doing so, they're obviously able to really meet the application requirements that they have, not just today, but also plan for the future for that, being able to scale those with the additional use of the full spectrum that's available within the 5 gigahertz frequency. So that's certainly one area.
Let me jump in right there, if you wouldn't mind, Chris. That's great. I was also wondering if there's anything in particular about the 802.11n technology per se, which actually works in a fairly different manner than the legacy networks before it in terms of multiple input, multiple output, MIMO, spatial diversity, all kinds of fancy techniques that it uses to be more efficient and higher performing. Does that technology in and of itself bring forth any new management challenges, or does it actually improve how the airspace controls itself? Bruce? Did you want to maybe chime in?
Sure, Joni. Yeah, the 11N technology, certainly all the benefits are well known. I think some of the challenges with respect to the RF environment are certainly there with respect to supporting legacy, or I would say ABG clients at the same time as 11N. So the ability to separate and mitigate interference, or essentially the slowing down of the ability of the clients at the higher rates, the 11N rates, to communicate is one of the challenges. So being able to segment users from, say, legacy, I'll call it ABG clients, from 11N high-performance clients is one of the significant challenges. With the bandwidth that 11N brings to the equation, I think certainly just the increased use and expectations that we will see with our 11N deployments versus, say, wired deployments, as people start moving more and more of their applications wireless, we're going to have to then manage the use of that bandwidth as well. One of the big ways that we handle it within our product is being able to, and I think Chris mentioned before, is 5 gigahertz, moving more and more towards the 5 gigahertz spectrum, where there is literally 8 times the bandwidth to work with. And then adding additional radios to allow you to then stretch out across that channels and leverage all that bandwidth for your users. Trying to combine them together and deal with the limits of 2.4 is certainly one of the areas that we've seen problems with in the past, due to the noise and just the limited channel capacity.
What if I had the luxury to build a greenfield 802.11n environment, and I had all 11n clients and all 11n access points, and let's say I was going to build it in the 5 gigahertz band, would there be any RF management tools that I might need in 11n that perhaps were not necessary in 802.11abg networks? Kevin, did you want to jump in on that?
Sure, Joni, thanks. At Motorola, we've always taken a look at the airspace and tried to proactively determine what new technology like N is going to bring to an enterprise in terms of manageability and interference protection, et cetera. N brings with it is we've talked about a few minutes ago here. N brings with it a couple of challenges. One is the additional range, as well as the enhanced throughput, ability to do channel bonding, elements in MIMO that were not available in ABG.
And those sound like benefits. Do they need to be managed in some way that we're not accustomed to in the earlier networks?
Absolutely, Joni. I'll explain why. The normal wireless network administrator has worked off of a kind of a rule of thumb that they've been comfortable with in terms of space between adjacent APs, what type of channel overlap there might be. The world has changed with N, and all of those old rules of thumb no longer apply to a pure N network. And that's the question you're asking, but of course they get even more complex in a mixed environment with an N or an AB and ABG client on that network.
Mm-hmm.
So the approach that we're providing our customers, Joni, is tools are absolutely paramount at this point. And we offer and provide our customers our LAN Planner, which operates on Motorola's LAN Planner, which operates on A, B, G, and N. It's multimodal across both frequency spectrums. And it's a very simple, easy-to-use tool that administrators can go and plug in their network, what type of traffic they'd have on that network, whether it's voice, data, combination thereof, and out will pop the report based on a CAD drawing that they've put into, and, of course, some other data that they've put into the tool. That report then to management, Joni, gets downloaded directly to our Motorola RFMS or RF management suite. So the actual design is downloaded automatically into the suite. The network can be deployed, and then any kind of minor tweaks that need to happen can happen between the planning and management tool, whether it's radio power, et cetera. We've automated this process as opposed to the old, spray and pray type of mentality that perhaps used to happen in the past.
Yeah.
We've made it easier. The tools are absolutely paramount. We provided world-class tools. We think that's the absolute best way for folks to move down.
let's let Chris and Bruce talk a little bit about the tools that they might have. I guess we've kind of gotten into a site survey discussion here, but Chris, did you want to talk about what Cisco recommends in terms of an automated site survey, a manual site survey, both? What's
their
kind of best practice there?
Yeah, I think it depends a lot on kind of the environment into which
mm-hmm.
wireless is being deployed. Again, most of Cisco's customers, as they look to adopt 11N, and we certainly agree with Kevin's statements of obviously using a breadth of tools to help facilitate the deployment, but also definitely using integrated tools within the system to then help on the ongoing operations. But with respect to site surveys, it's definitely important, I think, to understand the application requirements of that environment. Within Cisco's solution offerings, we certainly provide the ability to automate a lot of the planning of the network and also to deliver reports in terms of testing around, is the network ready for voice? Is the network capable of handling location, and provide that type of guidance to help the network administrator ensure that that they're meeting their objectives. But definitely when it comes to deploying wireless in critical environments, we do see a lot of customers continue to go through a site survey process. And in fact, I think you'd be hard pressed to find really a customer who is looking to rely on their wireless network for truly mission critical applications. Not wanting to actually have some comfort level that they've gone through and at least tested and validated their performance of how they've deployed their network throughout that facility. So
you mean manually walking around and tested?
Well, certainly, we definitely do think for specific applications, yes, it is important to conduct an actual physical site survey.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there's not necessarily here a one-size-fits-all, and Cisco's approach really is to provide the flexibility through our partners, A, to help do a manual site survey if that is deemed to be important, or use the tools that we provide to help automate that. So, but generally speaking, if the customer is looking at deploying voice, more intensive apps like video, we would typically recommend a site survey.
Okay. And I'm going
to come back to you. Joni, can I jump on that one as well then?
Yes, and I'm going to come back to you, Chris, about the voice issue in a moment, but let's move over to Bruce at Xeris and ask what kinds of site survey and or RF management tools Xeris has and recommends for 11N.
Yeah, so for site surveys, I would say we have an approach a little bit different from some of the other vendors in terms of we espouse and work with active or live site surveys, I guess manual as you're calling them, in most every single situation. I would say 95% or greater, those surveys are done live on site with real equipment in the real environment. And we actually provide that service, from Xeris directly as well from the company for free. And the importance that we've seen in this is pretty significant. And especially as you move to 11N, I think even more so, because now you're dealing with legacy older clients as well as newer 11N clients. The primary reasons are just the dynamics of the RF environment, whether you have, a building where a predictive kind of model will break down when you try to get into the intricacies of the design of the environment. You have noise and interference that can be there from surrounding environments, other Wi-Fi devices, et cetera. Many variables with respect to installation. And sometimes moving a device literally 3 feet one way or the other can make the difference between coverage in a room that's sufficient or not. There's also application-specific requirements, as we alluded to earlier, such as voice or, say, high-density environments. So all those put together, we have over the years developed a procedure with respect to bringing out a live equipment, hooking up in the environment, and doing a live survey, and see that as being the only real way of getting complete confidence in the results. And the results in our case, we guarantee, if the coverage is not sufficient, we will provide additional arrays to fill in the gaps. We have seen at the gross end of the scale, sometimes 2-to-1 ratios of predictive tools, not providing the right number of device counts for AP designs. And obviously that's a difficult situation to put the customer in when they realize they have to purchase more equipment. So we've definitely gone down the mode of the active survey as being a primary tool. And we use standard type of tools that are available in the industry to do that.
So my question back to Bruce at Xeris is I can completely understand the necessity for a physical site survey, perhaps in addition to or even in lieu of a predictive or automated site survey. How do you do those physical site surveys on a very large scale, given that access points are generally mounted in ceilings, kind of hard to get to places? What's required, how laborious and how time-consuming is it if I've got more than a few access points, or in your case, arrays to install?
Right. We've spent a few years refining and honing the procedure, but it's pretty straightforward. The arrays themselves have directional high-range antennas, so you use a lot fewer devices for one thing, so the survey doesn't require as many specific points to survey from. We have tripods that will extend up to 14 feet in the air, so we can easily put the array in an approximate location to its actual physical installation very easily. Or if it's an industrial setting, from the ceiling, we can just do a tie wrap on a location, a temporary kind of install to get a feel for what's going on at that point. So with a single device with the array and not having a controller or cables that is needed, it's very quick to get up and running very fast, and then we deploy teams of people in large deployments that can do multiple then locations simultaneously, so multiple teams that can move through the environment. So that process has been honed and refined. We have, documents which train our team on exactly how to do it in the most optimal way, and we've seen very efficient results from that.
Okay. So let's get down to something fairly basic. In general, I'd like to ask each of you what primary mechanisms or features your 11N systems use to avoid co-channel interference. And by that, I mean co-channel interference perhaps with other members of your own Wi-Fi network, and also perhaps with devices that might be owned and operated by other entities. And I'm thinking first and foremost in a multi-tenant environment where there might be multiple private networks operating side by side or on top of each other, and you need to be able to identify those devices and get some kind of common channel plan together. So I was wondering if each of you could kind of talk through maybe some of the best practices that your company might have and any system features that you might have to help along with that. Let's start with Kevin from Motorola.
Great. Thanks, Joni. So the answer that Motorola would kind of provide to our customers along these lines is it's really threefold, I'll bridge back to the discussion on planning just for a brief second, because that's part of our answer. The first way to mitigate and provide a robust, resilient network is to ensure planning was done properly. I think there is a difference between Motorola's approach and that of Xeris's in that we see the manual survey to test for interference, et cetera, as well as proper design, as being a tertiary type of approach, where our land planner tool, which, by the way, Motorola acquired Wireless Valley a couple of years ago, which is the number one vendor of 802.11n land planning in the industry at the time, and of course still is under the Motorola brand now, was an extremely powerful tool, and we've grown significantly. We can put in sources of interference. We can emulate in the tool. For example, to use a silly example, but one all of us see if we design wireless networks is microwaves. We literally take a CAD drawing of the building, which includes the metal in the building, and download that into the tool, and the tool will account for that in the various technologies and account for the volume of traffic, again, whether it's voice, video, or data, in a specific area, and lay the traffic out appropriately in the proper channels. In addition, so that's number one, is let's get the plan right first, utilizing the power of the tools as opposed to the kind of peck and hunt type of approach with the manual survey. But second, we'll utilize the power of the wireless network itself. Our smart RF platform, which is in each of our wireless switches, automatically takes a look at, senses the network, senses the traffic, senses the channel capacity, and makes adjustments on the fly to ensure that the network is tuned properly and channels are appropriate for the specific dynamic nature of traffic, which is becoming more and more as we're all utilizing our wireless networks in a bigger manner. So that's built in. We'll raise access point power automatically. We'll lower it automatically. We'll fill holes if there's a happen to be a hole in the network for whatever reason. Someone perhaps cuts a cable as they're up in the rafters putting new lighting in, as an example. That's a key element of keeping a network resilient. We do that automatically. It's built into the management system and the operating system of the wireless network that we provide. And then, Joni, the third I'd mention, which I think is also very important in terms of managing interference in a multi-tenant facility,
mm-hmm.
Is actually part of our advanced troubleshooting and our security offering. And Motorola provides a very resilient wireless intrusion protection system via our acquisition of Air Defense last year that can not only ensure that interference is prevented from affecting normal operation. I think another very important point is that interference can be identified with our wireless intrusion protection tool as a rogue if someone is intentionally or unintentionally, for that matter, trying to enter the airspace of the facility that you're in. So those tools are available in our wireless intrusion protection system to, not only prevent unauthorized access, but also prevent interference with and mitigating that interference with the tool.
And Chris, in that vein, I believe you have the spectrum analyzer, correct?
Yeah, that's right. And actually, I would kind of maybe expand a little bit on what Kevin mentioned here. So definitely in planning, I would Cisco would certainly look at reducing co-channel interference largely actually through the use of the 5 gigahertz frequency.
Mm-hmm.
So again, kind of moving customers into that domain, you certainly provide that many more channels that they can use, right? So there's far fewer interference between channels because we just have more. Certainly within the Cisco Unified Wireless Network, we offer the ability really to dynamically change channels or assign channel settings or, Kevin stated as well, change power output levels and the like. All of that is automated, which, makes it certainly easier for the customer as changes occur in that environment. And really there's flexibility for the customer to say, this is a dynamic environment. I want the system really taking more of an active role, or, perhaps I've done my site survey. I want things to stay pretty much as I've configured them. And so there's that level of flexibility within the tool to allow that variance. But as it relates to intrusion prevention, Cisco has long for really some time now believed that this is part of the infrastructure. And, it's great to see other folks in the industry acknowledging that integration as well. I think we take it one step further in comparison to other providers in terms of not just looking at the Wi-Fi space and what's happening within Wi-Fi, but also looking beyond that. So there's a lot of devices that interfere within the 2.4 and the 5 gigahertz frequencies, Bluetooth, microwave ovens, cordless phones, the list goes on. And as part of our system, we're able to detect these in addition to Wi-Fi activity because oftentimes these can really be a key source of interference. And so you want the system to be able to make decisions both based on Wi-Fi sources of interference and also non-Wi-Fi sources of interference. So we look at that area as well.
And could you just explain a little bit about when you say you look at that,
mm-hmm.
what actually does the system automatically adjust to avoid this interference, or does the system identify, there's a baby monitor in the building next door, I need to go over there and ask them to turn it off? I mean, how automated can you be, and how much is more alert-oriented or identification-oriented?
Right. Well, definitely, I think we all in general need to play by the rules that the FCC has provided, which, generally requires us not to, automatically shut things down or interfere with other people's activities. But I think the first step to be able to manage is to just be able to see. And so with the Cisco Spectrum Expert tool, we're able to actually gain visibility and identify, based on RF fingerprinting, the source of the interference. so we can actually tell you this is an RF jammer or this is a microwave oven. And now we do have integration into our management solution that allows us then to depict the source of that interference on, you know, visually with respect to the floor plan. But there is definitely a certain level of we need to be careful with respect to how automated we ultimately make these things because, again, we need to respect the FCC rulings and rules around,
you know. It's an unlicensed spectrum after all.
It's an unlicensed spectrum. Yeah. You know, we need to play fair. But, again, obviously, if that microwave oven or if that cordless phone is within the jurisdiction of the enterprise, they certainly then can look to locate that and then obviously remove it if it's causing a problem.
Now, Bruce, does Xeras also do some of these things in terms of enhancing or lowering power levels, et cetera, as appropriate to mitigate interference?
Yes, I think as opposed to maybe the survey discussion where there was more differences here, I think most vendors have these kinds of tools, and certainly Xeras does as well, in the respect of having the ability to automatically plan the channel assignments, the cell size, and tuning those kind of parameters to basically optimize a coverage. I think that probably some of the bigger differences, and, you know, by the way, there's always going to be some level of you know, issue out there with respect to channels. So you have to have a dynamic, you know, interference on these channels. You have to have a dynamic ability to adjust and to be able to account for these kinds of things. I think one of the more fundamental differences here is just in the architecturally how you approach it. And one of the things that we do with a multi-radio sectored antenna array type of design is introduce additional channels into the air. So if there are issues with respect to certain channels, you're able to have the selection across, you know, 3, 4, 5 at any given physical location, which gives you the ability to move away from issues when they do pop up. In some cases, you're forced to, obviously, the DFS channels, but in many cases, if you have a problem on channel one and you just can't get rid of it, you know, that user can move over to another channel to mitigate the issue. So with a multi-radio design, and we really see that down the road, you'll see more and more of these kinds of things coming into the market to allow you to take advantage of the 5 gig and the additional spectrum that's there, as opposed to trying to squeeze more juice out of the lemon, so to speak, with a single channel or, you know, a subset of channels that you're working with that have only so much bandwidth available to them. And certainly in 2.4, that bandwidth is getting squeezed out by many other devices. The interference on 2.4 is huge in some environments, and it's very hard to get a lot of throughput there. So, you know, the answer obviously is move to where there is more capacity and channel spectrum in the 5 gig and spread yourself out to mitigate the issues on particular channels by giving you the option to work across many. And I think that's one of the architectural differences here that you can really point to as a way of you know, broadening the scope of the problem, as opposed to trying to focus specifically on the issue on a given channel that you're having to deal with.
And Bruce, both Kevin from Motorola and Chris from Cisco had mentioned, in passing anyway, the integration of intrusion prevention systems, wireless intrusion prevention systems, into their systems.
Right.
And I was wondering, I'm not 100% sure, is that something that Xeras has as well? Integrated, could one of the radios in your arrays be a WIPS sensor, so to speak, and be checking for rogues?
Yes.
You do have that.
Yes. We have with the multi-radio design, one of the advantages is we can take one of those radios out of the 4, 8, or 16 that are in the product and dedicate it for 100% channel scanning to basically do detection of different threats and vulnerabilities in the network in addition to actually doing the blocking, you know, the attack mitigation as well. And then there's also a spectrum analyzer built in so that each array has its own view of the spectrum across all 35-plus channels in 2.4 and 5 gig. And then they could be centrally managed from an actual IPS IDS perspective. So, that's also built into the product for Xeras.
I wanted to ask all three of you. We've talked a lot about the need for dynamic control of the airspace, changing the power levels, the channels, et cetera, as conditions change, which makes perfect sense. And, Chris, I told you I was going to come back and ask you a little bit about voice. How do all these changing conditions affect as you mentioned, Chris, you really have to consider the applications when you're doing your mm-hmm. planning and surveying and whatnot. How do I run voice in this very dynamic environment when voice is really kind of a picky application that expects set power levels and
sure.
predictable conditions and a certain amount of bandwidth and no dropped packets, et cetera. And I'd like each of you to throw in your three comments about that.
Yeah, I'd say really just to start it off here, I mean, clearly we all recognize the requirements that voice over Wi-Fi places on the network. The good news is that 11N really does help with this. And we've had, a large number of customers actually move towards 11N deployments really for the effect that MIMO technology brings to increase reliability and predictability of coverage within their environment. And, of course, even though most of the voice over Wi-Fi handsets, whether it be a single-mode phone or a dual-mode phone, don't have the ability yet inherently to support 11N as far as a Wi-Fi component within the
Correct.
Device,
yep.
but they still can take advantage of the enhancements that that MIMO provides. Now, I will say, in addition to that, one of the things that Cisco recently announced is our client link technology, which actually uses beamforming, which we've delivered in silicon as part of our chipset, which uses beamforming to effectively increase the throughput to, I guess, what we could kind of call now legacy devices, 11A, 11G devices, that increases both the throughput and overall system capacity for both GA and N devices. And so the net result there that we've seen for voice clients is, of course, also just improved coverage, improved throughput for those clients as well. So in many cases, for enterprises that don't want to have to upgrade or expect, in some cases expect to see an influx of dual-mode devices that will support G or A, we're looking at certainly optimizing those through MIMO, but then taking it a step further and using technologies like Client Link to improve both coverage and throughput for those applications as well.
Okay. Anybody else, though? But here's something that is a question that sort of is a follow-on to that, which is that depending on the voice device, the voice client that might be in use, the vendor of that application / device usually has specific signal-to-noise ratio, signal strength, transmit power settings that they suggest would be best for their application to run. Now, let's say I have a mix of voice clients in my environment. How do I tune my environment to make all of the devices happy and work optimally? Does anybody have a good best practice for that? Bruce or Kevin?
Yeah, I can jump in on that one. This is Bruce. Basically, the criteria for surveying the network and establishing the design is based on, obviously, the requirements of the individual components in the network. So in this case, if you had multiple voice vendors involved, et cetera, you would basically look at the requirements for those systems. And typically there's, for example, an RSSI value, a minimum level that's required for successful operation. So you would take the least common denominator and then apply that across the network design. In the case of our Zero surveys, we typically, for example, survey for NEG 67, NEG 68 dBm mm-hmm. for voice, maybe NEG 70, NEG 72 for data. Depends on the customer requirements. But I think the bottom line is basically plan for success ahead of time by surveying and ensuring that you have sufficient signal quality and level at all points within the network, and then take into account interference and things like that at the same time. You know, the voice deployments, historically have had trouble in the Wi-Fi space, and I think many times it's just based on the fact that the design itself was faulty. You have to ensure that you have the robust coverage needed. That's what the voice systems need, and then you can ensure success.
So let's say we had a Vocera badge that has perhaps maybe the harshest or most difficult requirements because it's low power and if I set my environment, say, for a Vocera badge, does that mean that perhaps a Spectralink handset or a Cisco wireless handset would probably be running just fine if I'm kind of at that lowest common denominator?
Well, Joni, it's Kevin from Motorola. Let me try and jump in on this one a little bit, too. You're bringing up a great point, and I'll agree certainly with Bruce's point, that planning to the client level is critical.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, the lowest common denominator is an important criteria if you have multiple vendors' voice devices on network.
Right.
So your approach is a very real one in some cases, and your suggestion is the correct one from our view, from Motorola's view, which is plan to that lowest common denominator and then utilize the power within the network, our smart RF, as I mentioned earlier, to ensure that as that network dynamic changes, the power is moved up and down as appropriate to ensure the right level of connectivity to the device. There's one element, though, that I would certainly like to bring out with regard to our implementation of voice over WLAN. First of all, Motorola has, from our calculations, one of the largest voice over WLAN networks running, private networks running in the country right now. And I'd be happy to talk to any of your readers, et cetera, about that individually. The reason we do is Motorola has really relied and capitalized on our history, Joni. We've done handoffs, which is basically the same thing as a cellular handoff for much of our history. We have IP around that. So actually, quality of service or total quality of service for a voice over WLAN implementation is probably more to do with the handoff than it is to do with the connectivity power while connected to one AP. So we really feel that that an area around beamforming is an area that we've seen our customers struggle with as they move from access point to access point. And a drop packet on voice is very, very obvious in comparison to a drop packet on data as you're walking down the halls of a hospital or through a large carpeted space in an enterprise.
Sure.
We have mastered that. We have utilized not only the standards. We developed the standards, quite frankly, and put our technology into the standards for fast roaming. So I just wanted to share that with your audience, that certainly that handoff part is critical.
Okay, thank you. That said, I think we're running out of time here, but I wanted to thank everybody for joining us today, and I know that we've really only scratched the surface of this topic, but hopefully it'll get people thinking and drive some questions, further questions, in the minds of the listeners, and hopefully they will be contacting you if they have a question on anything that you might have said today. Does anybody have any final thoughts that they wanted to share before we sign off?
I want to thank Joni for monitoring our session, and a special thanks to Chris, Bruce, and Kevin for their valuable input. This is just one of five discussions we have on 802.11n, so I encourage you to check out the other sessions. You can also find out more on the vendor's individual solutions on the text part of the challenge, which is, of course, on the 802.11n Wi-Fi challenge page at WebTorials. And I especially encourage you to contact the vendors and any of our sponsors in the challenge for more information on 802.11n and how they can help your business, and to follow up on anything you heard today. Again, thank everybody.